You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is Friday. It is time for Brunch with Bernie. And hang on just a second here, Bernie. I'm sorry. I've got to get my software working. There we go. There he is. Senator Sanders is on the line with us. Sanders.senate.gov is website. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. And apologies for the pause there. You've got a lot on your plate between Citizens United and the Buffett rule and the post office. I know there's a lot going on in your office.
There is. And Congress will be, at least the Senate, will be reconvening on Monday night. And I think front and center will be this issue of the Buffett rule, which is pretty simple. The reality now is, I think most listeners know, that in America we have growing income and wealth inequality, which is reaching really staggering and embarrassing levels. Recently, Tom, there was a study that came out about all new income created between 2009 and 2010. And if you can believe it, I mean, it's really just almost beyond belief, is that 93% of all new income in this country between 2009 and 2010 went to the top 1%, 93% of that.
Wow.
And we live in a country where the top 400 wealthiest people own more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans, and the gap between the people on top and everybody else is growing wider and wider. Now, meanwhile, in the midst of all this, we have a huge deficit that was caused primarily by Bush's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that Bush forgot to pay for, huge tax breaks for the very wealthiest people. And we're looking at a moment when the people on top have an effective, i.e. real tax rate, that is not only lower than many, many people in the middle class, but the lowest that it has been in decades. So you have a huge deficit and unmet needs in this country. Rich are getting richer. Their effective tax rate is the lowest in decades. And what some of us are trying to do is say, wait a second, before you start cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and education and nutrition programs, maybe, just maybe, we want to ask the people on top who are doing phenomenally well to start paying their fair share in taxes. And that's what this Buffett rule is about. Because here you have Buffett, one of the richest people in the United States, worth many, many billions, paying an effective tax rate lower than his secretary, lower than many police officers or nurses or teachers, et cetera, et cetera. So that is, to me, an issue not only of fairness. It really is an issue of economics in the sense that you need to deal with deficit, but you don't want to do it by cutting programs and taking income away from working families, because putting money in their pockets are how you're going to stimulate the economy. So it is appropriate, in my view, to ask the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share. It is absolutely appropriate to start ending many of these loopholes by which large corporations like ExxonMobil and others in some years make billions of dollars in profit and not pay a nickel in taxes, so in federal income taxes. So I strongly support the Buffett rule, think we should go further, and I think we've got to put that issue of growing income and wealth inequality on the table and begin to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the context of that, we're seeing now all these super PACs coming out.
Absolutely.
As well as Citizens United.
I mean, what's going on now is you're seeing a level of greed, of avarice, of aggressiveness on the part of the very rich that has not been seen probably since the 1920s. You know, I think for many, many decades in America, in, you know, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, there were always, you know, conflicts, needless to say, between big money and everybody else, between corporations and workers. That goes without saying that those conflicts took place. But you're seeing now a new level, a level that we haven't seen for a very long time, and that is the rich are saying, you know what, I am really rich, and I want to become richer, and I really don't care that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major nation on earth. I don't care that 50 million Americans have no health insurance. I don't care that kids are graduating college deeply in debt and can't find jobs. I don't really care. All I care about is how I'm going to make even more money, how I'm going to pay even less in taxes, and I'm going to use some of my wealth because of my friends on the Supreme Court through Citizens United to now spend, you know, huge sums of money on campaigns and radio and television advertising to elect those people who are going to make my life being a billionaire even easier and screw everybody else. And that's really what it's about. And I think it's time, and we are beginning to see that fight back taking place in states like Wisconsin and elsewhere, where people are saying enough is enough. This country and government has got to work for everybody and not just the people on top. And we're going to get involved in the political process. So that's really what this whole Buffett rule is about. It's saying that the wealthiest people in this country have got to respect the fact that they are Americans, and they've got to help us address some of the very serious problems that we face.
Yeah. And the post office, you're working, you're still, I'm curious how this is going along.
Yeah, we are. And just yesterday, I believe, there were demonstrations, I think, by the letter carriers or other unions as well, in actually supporting legislation that I've introduced to say, yes, the Postal Service has got to change, but we can do it in a way without laying off or diminishing the size or downsizing the Postal Service by over 200,000 workers, many of whom, by the way, are veterans. And there are ways to do that. My understanding is that on Tuesday afternoon, perhaps, the postal bill is going to get to the floor of the Senate. We hope that we will have Republicans working with Democrats and I as an independent in making that bill as strong as it possibly can be and preventing the shutting down of thousands of rural post offices, of hundreds of mail processing plants, of slowing down mail delivery service. There are ways to protect the Postal Service and those jobs without massive shutdowns and downsizing of the Postal Service. And that's what we're working hard on. We've made some progress in the last few weeks. There's a manager's amendment that I helped with others to write, but we have to go further in terms of the amendment process. So I hope that people will be calling up their senators and saying, hey, let us protect hundreds of thousands of jobs, keep the Postal Service strong. There are ways that they can bring in new revenue, and that's the direction we've got to go, rather than just shutting down processing plants and cutting back the workforce.
Now, the post office is the second largest employer in the United States and the largest unionized employer, and the Republicans tend not to support such things.
Well,
I'm curious how
right.
This is going to pass in the House.
I think that is certainly one of the factors. We're working on legislation, obviously, in the Senate where I am. There's other legislation in the House which is very, very draconian, very bad.
Mm.
But we believe there is a possibility. You never predict anything in terms of what Congress may or may not do. But
right.
If we pass something halfway decent in the Senate, we hope that and think there's a chance that we'll have the votes in the House. Because, you know, conservative Republicans also coming from rural districts don't want to see their post offices shut down, which are so important for their people, don't want to see workers being laid off. So we hope we can accomplish something. We've made some progress in recent months, and I want to see that progress continued. I also want to mention to listeners that we continue to work very hard on the Citizens United issue that we just discussed a moment ago, which in my view, and I think the view of many Americans, is one of the worst decisions ever rendered by the United States Supreme Court. Allowing billionaires and corporations to go right into their treasuries, corporate treasuries, take out huge sums of money and put it into the political process. The Vermont State Senate just voted yesterday to urge the Congress to pass a constitutional amendment. I'm proud of what Vermont did. We joined Hawaii and New Mexico in doing that.
That's great.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls right after this, 15 minutes past the hour.
The fact is that those good people who live at the top of our economic pyramid are much further away from the poorhouse, and you and I know that as a matter of personal observation.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. He has his constitutional amendment there to amend to reverse Citizens United, the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter, and all kinds of great stuff. Larry in Kalmar, Iowa. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom. This is Larry, and I'd like to say hi to my favorite senator, Mr. Bernie Sanders. What I wanted to say was that they're revamping the outside of the Congress, congressional building there, and I wondered if this November we could revamp the House and the Senate there and try to get rid of a few of these just say no Republicans that you've been having a heck of a time with there.
Well, Larry, I concur with you. I think it is really important that every American understand the dynamic of what is happening in Washington right now. Our country today is dealing with many, many serious problems. In fact, more problems than we've had to deal with since the Great Depression. And what we have got to understand is the reason we are in where we are right now is largely having to do with these disastrous right-wing programs and concepts, such as giving huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and arguing that through trickle-down theory, this is going to benefit working families and the middle class. We saw that program play out under the Bush administration. And the idea that you have Mitt Romney and Republican candidates for the House and Senate saying, hey, we want to go back to the Bush economic policies of more tax breaks to the rich. We want to go back to more deregulation. When we went through the deregulation of Wall Street, which led us into this recession right now because of their ability to merge commercial banks with investment banks, with insurance companies, Republicans are saying, we want even more unfettered free trade. During the Bush years, we lost tens and tens of thousands of factories, millions of good-paying jobs, companies shutting down, moving to China, moving to Mexico, moving to every low-wage country imaginable. And they want more of that. So I think, you know, getting back to the question that, you know, both Sandra and Larry asked, what we have to do is to take a hard look, not at personality, you know, not worrying about Mitt, not Romney's wife or anything else. The real issue is what do these guys believe? And what they believe is policy after policy, which makes the wealthiest people in this country even wealthier. And what these guys really want to do is take us back to the 1920s. Some of these people, some of these Republicans don't just want to cut Social Security or Medicare. They believe, if you can believe this, they believe that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is unconstitutional. We had Etta May calling a little while ago saying she's having problems as somebody on Medicare with dental care. You got more and more Republicans who say, forget Medicare. It's not a question of whether we provide dental care. We don't believe that seniors are entitled to Medicare. If you're old and you don't have any money, good luck to you. Go out and find a private insurance company. Or maybe we'll give you a voucher plan for a few thousand dollars. That's what they believe in. If you're on the minimum wage now, minimum wage is too low. There are some of these people who say, hey, let's repeal the minimum wage. The United States has a very bad record in terms of worker safety. Too many people get killed or injured. Some of our Republican friends say, hey, let's repeal OSHA. That's up to the employer and a worker. Repeal the minimum wage. If we can hire you at $2 an hour, $3 an hour, what's the problem? Repeal the Department of Energy. Repeal the EPA. So a lot of kids are breathing crap in the air that come from corporations that are polluting the air. Government shouldn't be involved in that. So what you are looking at now is a unprecedented assault on the rights of working people, on the gains that the middle class has made over the last 70 and 80 years, on women's rights. These guys want to repeal all of that. And people have got to understand what the stakes are. Should Obama be stronger, standing up more firmly to the Republicans? I think he should. But we have got to be mindful in the midst of all of that what the right-wing Republican agenda is, and that is to move this country to an oligarchic form of society where a handful of billionaires control the economic and political life of this nation, and that is something we must not allow it to happen.
Corky in Rochester, New York. We got about a minute. Maybe you can ask a question. Bernie can answer it after the break. Corky?
Yes. I would like to get back to the charts, Senator Sanders. Gas prices are going to be an issue in this election. We have to show the people where it goes the minute it comes out of the ground, where it goes to get refined, and how it gets to our gas tank. It doesn't come out of our ground to our refineries. It comes out of the ground, it goes to the world market, and then we buy it back. You have to show charts to the American people that this is where the gas is going. This is how it gets in your tank. Most people don't understand that.
Okay. The same thing with
Corky. Corky, thank you.
You make a good point. And, Tom, do we have time to get into that now, or should we?
I would get about 10 or 15 seconds.
All right. Well, Corky makes a good point. We'll talk about it after the break. In my view, there are a lot of reasons why gas prices have spiked off the wall over $4 a gallon here in Vermont. And they have not to do with supply and demand. There are other factors, and we'll discuss them in a moment.
We will get right back to gas prices with Senator Bernie Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news source, as well as, you know, the portal into Bernie's world, in what he's doing, what he's up to. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, over at TomHartman.com, you can get our free iPad and iPhone app. You can join our message boards. You can participate in our free live chat room. Lots of cool stuff.
Lost working time is lost money. Every day that a workman is unemployed, or a machine is unused, or a business organization is marking time, it is a loss to the nation.
Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, and our national town hall meeting taking your calls. And, Bernie, the last caller was asking about gas prices.
Corky from New York State was asking about gas prices. Let me just say a few words. You know, Tom, when you look at how the middle class of this country is getting beaten up every single day by big money interest and corporate America, I think there's no better example than what's happening with gas prices. You know, when we were kids and we were in elementary school, we learned about the laws of supply and demand. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And then when there's a lot of supply and there's limited demand, prices go down. And there's a lot of demand and limited supply, prices go up. That's what we learned in elementary school and high school. Well, guess what? People may be surprised to know this, but the reality is that in America right now, we have a heck of a lot of oil supply. In fact, we have more oil right now than we did 3 years ago when the price of a gallon of gas was $1.94 a gallon. Okay? $1.94 a gallon. We have less demand now than we have had since 1997, and internationally, the growth in supply over demand is also fairly significant. So given the fact we have more supply and less demand, how and why are oil prices soaring? Well, there are a couple of reasons. Number one, you're back to the same old with our friends at the oil industry, ExxonMobil and the others, who make phenomenal profits. That's just the simple reality. Their profits soar. In the last 10 years, the major oil companies have made over $1 trillion in profit. 10 years. Unbelievable. Then what you have is, combined with that, you have our good friends on Wall Street who apparently felt that it was not enough through their greed to drive this country into the horrendous recession we're in right now. They are now speculating very heavily on the oil futures market. Over 80% of the oil futures market is controlled by Wall Street speculators and not people who actually use the product. And there's all kinds of evidence out there that suggests that is also causing a significant increase in gas prices. Goldman Sachs itself, probably the major speculator, has released a study which says that speculation is adding about 56 cents to a gallon of gas. Furthermore, what you have, and this is unbelievable, and somebody mentioned this on the show a couple of weeks ago, is right now with oil and gas prices going off the wall, the oil companies and the gas companies are actually exporting oil abroad. So you got all of those factors, which just tell you that the average American is being beaten up rather unmercifully by the oil industry and the Wall Street speculators. These are issues we are working very, very hard on, but I should tell listeners that both Wall Street and the oil companies are very, very powerful in Washington through their lobbying, through their campaign contributions, through their tie-in with Citizens United organization. So that's the struggle we face. And it's not only this is the high oil prices are not only impacting individuals in rural states like Vermont, they are impacting our entire economy. So we're going to stay on this issue, but it's tough sledding.
Greg, in Paraine, New Jersey, am I pronouncing that right, Greg?
Paraine, Tom.
Okay, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Sanders, we all know that our country has a revenue problem, which I believe is caused by having supply-side economics and free trade at the same time. If we raise the tax rate on the rich up to 39%, it would generate more revenue, but would not create one single job. So what I would like to know from you is, if we the people loaded up the House and Senate with progressives, do you believe that we could repeal free trade and get our hardworking Americans back to work, stimulating the economy by paying their fair taxes, revenue, and creating a demand by, once again, purchasing durable goods labeled made in the USA?
Greg, I think that's an excellent point, and the answer to your question is, I think yes. I'm sorry to interrupt you. You raise two important issues. Number one is tax fairness, asking the wealthiest people to stop paying their fair share of taxes, which will help us, among other things, with deficit reduction. And you raise another question, equally important, if not more important, is how we start creating decent-paying jobs in America. And for years now, Tom and I have been talking about the absurdity of trade policies, unfettered free trade policies. You don't want to eliminate all trade. Trade is a good thing because in many cases it can benefit the American worker. What you have now is a situation where American workers are being forced to compete against people who make pennies an hour. You have a situation now where companies are given a green light, shut down in America, move to China, move to Vietnam, bring your products back into this country. And the result is that, along with automation, in the last 10 years or so, we have lost something like 60,000 factories in America, millions of good-paying jobs. So the effort, Greg, to create a situation where we're rebuilding our manufacturing base and paying workers who do manufacturing jobs decent wages, where America is, Americans are buying products made in the USA, is exactly right. And I don't see us having the kind of economy we need unless we make very basic changes to our trade policies.
Diane in Lansing, Michigan, watching us on Free Speech TV. Diane, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. My question is, why is there a cap on Social Security? I mean, I've paid into it for 28 years, and hasn't everybody pretty much paid into it at one point or another?
The answer is yes, almost everybody has paid into it. And the reason what Diane is talking about is that right now people pay into the Social Security Trust Fund based on only the first $110,000 they earn. So if you make $1 million, you're only paying into the Social Security Trust Fund based on $110,000. If you lifted that cap and you started at $250,000, not at $110,000, you would bring in enough revenue so that Social Security would be able to pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 75 years, which is where the actuaries would like us to be. Diane, what I would tell you is that is the legislation that I have introduced. We have a decent number of co-sponsors. It is the legislation that Obama ran on when he ran for president in 2008. So we have got to rally the American people to say, okay, Social Security today could pay out all benefits for the next 25 years, has a $2.5 trillion surplus, but we can and should do better than that. Lifting the cap is exactly the right thing to do, and we have legislation in to do that, Diane.
Kelly in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Kelly Gerling here. Hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, I really admire the fact that you are a person who represents the American people and the middle class. And what I want to ask you about is how to deal with the ultimate causes of the fact of plutocratic corporate rule, in particular regarding the Senate, of which you're a member. So there are two big problems in the Senate, disproportion and a lack of representation of regular people. So disproportion is a person in Wyoming voting for senator has 70 times the power of a person in California because of population. And the lack of representation is because simply how many young people are there? None below 30. How many regular income people such as you are there? None or very, very few. How many women? 15% roughly. So how do we deal with the ultimate causes of the Senate as represented by disproportion and the fact that it is not a body that looks like America? How do we fix that?
Because well, Kelly, you've asked a lot of very, very good questions. I suppose that I have to disagree with you in one area. Vermont is probably smaller than Wyoming, so...
Well, the flip side of that is I've been saying for a long time California should split itself into three states. New York into two states, Manhattan, you know, and Florida and Texas into two states, and then you would have actually a Democratic majority that would probably last forever.
Well, what I would say in more practical terms, you know, Kelly asked two good questions, basically, and he's worried that the Senate is essentially unfair because Vermont has, or Wyoming has the same representation as California. But then his other half of his question is that the power of money, I think, in determining who gets elected. And I would say that, Kelly, for whether it's Wyoming or Vermont or any other state in the union, the predominant question is how we represent, how we elect, ordinary people from the middle class, from the working class, who are gonna stand with their fellow Americans and not work night and day solely for the benefit of the wealthy and the powerful. And to do that, I think you've got to do, a number of things. First of all, of course, you've got to repeal the Citizens United, which makes a bad situation much worse in giving the rich even more power than they had before. But then you've got to go beyond that. And I think we have got to be talking very strongly about the concept of public funding of elections. If candidate A is a millionaire and candidate B is a working person, it's basically unfair that candidate A has just a huge advantage over candidate B. If candidate A is going to suck up to the big money interest and get all kinds of money from them, that's just not fair. What free elections are about is giving people, all people, a shot at getting elected and not the dominance of big money. So public funding of elections, I would say, Kelly, is a significant step forward in moving to create a legislature, a Congress, which represents ordinary people.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us taking your calls. Our national town hall meeting. We'll be right back with more Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov, G-O-V.gov.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Al in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yes. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Hartman and Senator.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you why the Democrats refuse to hold a press conference explaining in basic detail what the Republicans have done since they have gained control of the House. I think it's imperative that the Democrats hold a press conference. I think they should hold one every week. I think it's time the American people know that the Republicans have not offered a single jobs bill in the House or the Senate. Why is the president the only one beating this drum?
Well, Al, what I would say is that, you know, I can't tell you exactly how many press conferences the Democrats hold. They hold more than you think. And sometimes when people hold press conferences, the word does not necessarily end up on your TV screen.
But I think in terms of the Ryan budget, in terms of the obstructionism of the Republicans in the Senate, in terms of the reactionary nature of legislation passed in the House, which is going after and attacking the middle class and women, the Democrats are trying to do their best. Should they be doing more? The answer is yes. What really concerns me, I will tell you, and one of the criticisms I have as an independent of the Democrats, is that there are whole sections of this country in the South and the Southwest where the Democrats haven't placed strong candidates, put significant amounts of money into waging fights in those areas, fights that may not be won right now. But you got to start somewhere. And if you don't have an alternative point of view in Oklahoma or in Alabama or in Mississippi, people are not going to hear something different than what right-wing ideology is all about. So, Al, what I would tell you is there are probably more press conferences than you know, and it's not just the president, but it's not the situation that those press conferences get on TV every night.
John in Alameda, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Excuse me.
Oh, hi, Bernie, and thanks so much for your service to the country and for this program. My question is, you know, our government seems to me to be so broken. Our media and our elections are also broken so badly. My feeling is it's very unlikely that we'll have any progress on issues and that government can really repair itself. So is there any other way for Americans to alter and improve their government, which is, say, outside of Article 5, the Constitution, or Congress?
Well, I mean, I think, John, there is no question that, A, the problems facing this country are huge. We should not hide that for a moment. B, the Republican Party is owned by big money interests, and too many Democrats worry about big money rather than the working class and low-income people. That's all very, very true. I think, number one, you can't turn your back on the political process. It's just too important. Too many important decisions are made that we have to struggle to create a grassroots movement around a progressive agenda, which, in fact, is supported by the vast majority of the people in this country. One of the things that really irritates me is that if you look at the Republican right-wing agenda, tax breaks for the rich, cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, more money for the military. If you look at those issues, the American people do not support them. So what we need is a strong progressive agenda that speaks to the needs of working families, and that is health care for all people, creating millions of jobs by rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system. We talked about trade a moment ago, changing our trade policies. These are not just Bernie Sanders' ideas. These are ideas that more or less the vast majority of the American people believe in. Second of all, to answer your question, can you go outside of the political process? I think you can. I mean, I think you can be involved locally. I was the mayor of the city of Burlington, Vermont for 8 years. Didn't have all that much to do with the federal government. We did a whole lot of things at the local level, paying attention to the needs of the children, the needs of the elderly, our environment, women's issues. You can do that as well at the local level. Putting together cooperatives to start creating jobs, something that we can be doing. So not all the answers by any means are in Washington. I don't think you can ignore Washington. There's a heck of a lot. In terms of media, my goodness, we can start putting pressure on local radio stations to be allowing progressive voices to be heard rather than just the usual right-wing suspects. There's a lot that can be done at every level of society, and I think we have to play that game at every level of society.
Bernie, we got about a minute and a half here, so even though there's a bunch of people on hold, I don't think it would short shrift somebody. Your final thoughts for the week on what we need to be doing and thinking?
Well, this is what I think. I think, you know, sometimes I get dismayed when I turn on the TV and I hear a lot of the stuff that some of these commentators are blabbering about. Politics is not very complicated. What politics is about is, A, what are the problems that we're facing, and B, where do we want to go as a people, as a nation? Not personalities and not what some campaign aide said. That's media stuff. But I think if we focus on the real problems facing our country,
why is the middle class disappearing? Why is poverty increasing? Why are we seeing more and more income and wealth inequality? Why are we the only major country on earth not to have a national health care program? Why are we spending more money on defense than the rest of the world combined? If you start focusing on those issues, the truth of the matter is we know the answers. We know the answers. And what we have got to do is develop the kind of grassroots movement that elects strong progressives, that holds people accountable to the needs of working families, and not just the wealthiest people in this country. So I think what I would urge people to do is go beyond a lot of the media gossip. Don't worry about who Mitt Romney is going to be selecting as his vice presidential candidate. Worry about how we expand the middle class so that our kids do not have a lower standard of living than we do. What are the policies we need? And let's make our elected officials accountable to working families and not just the people on top.
You are so eloquent. Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday, although I do, I have to begin with a rant. My apologies, but we have big news from yesterday, I believe it was. Yeah, April 12th. Yes, today is Friday the 13th, so this was yesterday, that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling, which I spent the better part of half of today reading and marking up in mind-numbing detail. Three judges, John T. Noonan, Richard A. Paez, and Carlos T. Bea, circuit judges, three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled, and this was, you know, basically the decision on its surface. But there's, as Paul Harvey would have said, you know, there's the rest of the story, which I'll get to in just a second. They ruled that non-commercial stations, and this is one of the few programs in all of radio and television that is on both commercial stations and non-commercial stations. We basically are creating two simultaneous programs, and we're syndicated commercially by Dial Global to radio stations across the United States, regular commercial radio stations. We're syndicated by Pacifica Radio on radio stations. We're syndicated by Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, on nonprofit television stations, community television stations around the country. Some stations carry some NPR content and us and others, you know, whatever. That those non-commercial stations that up to this point in time, well, prior to 1981, prior to the first year of the Reagan administration, they took absolutely no statements of underwriting at all. NPR and the other community stations in this country, you know, they would do their pledge drives and they would, you know, solicit donations and things, but they couldn't talk about it on the air other than saying, please call in and donate some money. After 1981, for-profit companies and pretty much anybody else got the right, and this, again, the result of an FCC ruling in the first year of the Reagan administration, got the right to say, you know, this program is brought to you by Acme Widget Company. But they can't say, Therefore, Acme widgets are the very best widgets in the world. You need to get over to the Acme Widget Company website right this second and buy three of them. So there's still a bit of a barrier there. And frankly, I think that's a good thing. In fact, I'm personally, even though it would mean that I would probably lose most of my nonprofit affiliations, debatable, but in any case, I personally think that the pre-1981 rule was better. It said that nonprofit stations, you know, they air educational programming and whatnot. They air what they air, but there are no statements by any commercial entities at all or any other entities with an axe to grind. But that's not the world we live in. Anyhow, what the Ninth Circuit Court ruled, and it was actually ruled by the two Republican appointees on the court, and dissented by the one Democratic appointee on the court. What they ruled was that in at least in the states of Alaska, Arizona, California, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington, the states that are covered by the Ninth Circuit, that non-commercial stations, if Karl Rove comes to them and says, we want to run a Crossroads GPS ad that says, the, you know, Citizens United decision was the best thing since sliced bread, and please do not sign any petitions to overturn it, that those stations have to run those ads and take the money. It's going to turn frankly, I believe that if this decision stands, and in fact, in the decision, several times, the majority basically called out at the Supreme Court and said, pick this up and take it national. If this decision stands, it is going to turn NPR and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and all the other community stations out there into the litter box for Karl Rove. Now, the right-wingers will say, and in fact, Fox and Friends this morning had a conversation about, well, gee, now that this has happened, does that mean that the liberals are going to start advertising on Sesame Street? Well, yeah, if the liberals had any money. But, you know, the super PACs and the, you know, I don't, the banksters, I mean, if there's a law to deregulate the banks or a law to re-regulate the banks, it's being considered, either one. If it's before Congress, now these stations can be forced to carry this. Now, that was the stuff on the surface. And I think that was a bad decision. In fact, I thought the original ruling in 1981 was a bad decision. But here's where it goes from bad to bizarre. And I mean, like, genuinely bizarre. Let me just share with you the logic that these two Republicans, in particular Carlos Bea, the George W. Bush appointee on the court, used to overturn this piece of the federal communications rules or law. The logic that they used was that when Congress passed the law, they didn't get enough testimony. Let me just say this again. The majority Republicans on the Ninth Circuit Court ruled a law unconstitutional because when it was passed, Congress did not get enough or proper testimony so that when the judges in there, I mean, this is judicial review, this is judicial activism, this is judicial supremacy on steroids. So that when the judges reviewed the law, there wasn't enough of a record of why there would be a harm to the public because there wasn't enough testimony to the before Congress, so they're going to strike down the law. It's breathtaking. I'll read you from the decision. This is the majority decision. This is Judge Bea writing, the George W. Bush nominee in the Ninth Circuit. And he quotes the government's brief. In other words, the FCC saying we should uphold this law and not let Karl Rove start forcing NPR stations to carry his ads. And they say, ultimately, ultimately, the most revealing statement in the government's brief on this point is the following sentence, which contains no citations. And then he quotes the FCC. Political advertisers are no less capable of exerting influence on programmers than commercial advertisers, and accordingly, political advertising has never been permitted in public broadcasting. Okay, that's the quote from the FCC. And then he goes on to say, and this is in the decision, in the majority decision, if that preliminary statement of fact about the ability of political advertisers to exert programming influence were supported by some evidence, in particular some evidence before Congress when it enacted the ban, the government could sustain its burden under intermediate scrutiny. But at such a critical point, the government makes only a bare assertion, unsupported by citation to any evidence. The government cannot simply assert its way out of the substantial evidence requirement of the First Amendment. In other words, to make it really simple, because Congress didn't document why they made a law, they're going to strike this down. He goes on to say, of course, following today's decision, Congress is free to try again. If there truly is evidence that broadcast of public issues and political advertisements would cause substantial harm, that their broadcast would change program content, Congress could compile a record to show as such and perhaps pass a law restricting such speech. Now, in his dissent, The Justice Paez says, I disagree with Judge Bea's view that we may not consider evidence supporting the constitutionality unless evidence was presented before Congress. He says basically Congress, you know, to pass a law, there's only two constitutional requirements. One, that it passed the House and Senate, and two, that the president signed it. That's it. He said Judge Bea's conclusion that the constitutionality of a federal law might turn on the quantity and quality of evidence before Congress at the time of enactment violates this fundamental principle by effectively imposing a procedural requirement on Congress's legislative process. This is the judiciary telling Congress, you may not pass a law, or we will easily strike it down if you don't jump through these hoops. You think we're not living now in a judicial dictatorship?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And just like with the Citizens United decision, all the Republican appointees voted for this, all the Democrats voted against it. What a surprise.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a couple of quick announcements. First of all, if you're in the D.C. area, come support tomorrow's second annual Stroud Foundation 5K walk. Actually, so a 5K walk, run, and roll. In memory of the beloved pediatrician, fellow that I knew and know his wife and family. In fact, Louise and I had Thanksgiving dinner at their home a couple of years ago. Dr. Frank Stroud, benefiting children, the late Dr. Frank Stroud. This is a great organization. The 2K Run, Walk, and Roll here in Washington, D.C. benefits kids challenged by learning differences. And this year's honoree is Dr. Nathaniel Beers. He's the founder of the Early Stages Program that identifies learning delays. Registration is at 7 a.m., and the race is at 8 a.m. at the Capitol Crescent Trail in Georgetown. So for more information, go to stroudfoundation.org, Stroud, S-T-R-O-U-D. That's tomorrow morning. And then after that, come on over to We Act Radio. It's our newest affiliate here in Washington, D.C. We are carried live on We Act Radio every day on AM 1480. And they're in Anacostia, which is sort of a suburb of D.C., as it were, or the edge of D.C. And tomorrow, open house, a meet and greet, a live broadcast. I'm going to be dropping by probably around 2:30 or thereabouts. And I believe David Schuster is going to be broadcasting live from noon to 3 there. You can learn more about it, this whole community event, at Lumen, L-U-M-E-N, digit 8. Anacostia, anacostia.com, and you get to meet the WEACT crew, and I'll have some books I can sign for you. The address is 1918 MLK Avenue Southeast. It's near the Anacostia Metro stop, which I think is on the Green Line, as I recall, if you're in D.C. So a lot going on. Oh, and welcome to our newest TV affiliate station, Granby Community Television in Granby, Massachusetts, and also Marblehead Television in Marblehead, Massachusetts, just picked up our show, so... A lot going on. Okay, back to your calls and anything goes Friday. And Hank in Palmerton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Hank, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wonder if you have a comment on what I'm about to say.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, these Wall Street crooks have never been brought to justice. And I don't think Washington is going to help us with that. And number two...
We'll see. There is an ongoing FBI investigation. Justice Department is looking into some of the things that happened on Wall Street. I'm very hopeful that probably after the election you'll see some action on this. But let's, you know, on the other hand...
Number two, I think it was Che Guevara that said justice comes out of the barrel of a gun. I know that the government has all the planes and tanks, but I don't think that... American soldiers would shoot their own people. Would the American people ever rise up? That's it, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Hank. We tried that in the Civil War, and it didn't work out all that well. I mean, I don't mean that to like from the point of view of the South. I mean, when Lincoln engaged Lee in the very beginning, he thought the war was going to be over in a week and a half. And instead, 600,000 people dead later, the bloodiest per capita war in the history of this country, we were back as one nation. So, my recollection is that the actual quote isn't that justice comes out of the barrel of a gun, but the political power does. But I disagree with that. I think political power comes from mobilized grassroots movements. Political power comes from people getting active. So, let's see here. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon, thanks for listening to KBAI. What's up?
Hi. I have to admit some ignorance here. I was listening to Mike Papantonio the other day, and he was talking about the Obama jobs bill, and he was really, I didn't get to hear it all, and some of it I didn't understand. He really was, like, slamming it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just not that familiar with it and why it should, you know, if you can give me some enlightenment on what it's about and what's wrong with it.
I can't. I can. What I can tell you is that Matt Taibbi wrote the piece that got everybody going on this thing over in Rolling Stone, and I'm sure it's on their website at rollingstone.com right now. And I've been meaning to get Matt on this program to discuss it, but I don't have it in front of me, and I don't want to get into the details because I might get something wrong, and I just, okay. But Matt's main concern, I guess, is that at a certain level, this was spiffing corporations for hiring people, and that's a bad thing. But even that, you know, by characterizing it that way, I'm probably doing a very poor job. So, just hang on, and we'll get into that as time goes on. Ben in Winnipeg, Canada, we got a minute to the break. Ben, what's up?
Yeah, hi. This is Ben here. I'm wondering a little bit about the economy, how it's all going to go forward on a world scale and in the U.S. in particular.
Well, you guys are doing fine. Your banks never got deregulated, so they didn't crash.
That's absolutely true. I'm looking more at the underlying physics with the energy side. I mean, economic growth requires growth in energy consumption. And fossil fuels are coming to kind of a dead point there, so we need renewables basically.
Well, Canada, in Canada, you're building out wind and solar infrastructure aggressively, as are we actually. We have five states now that get more than 10% of their electricity from wind power, and that's growing. So I'm optimistic, even in the face of things like the XL pipeline and other things.
What I'm looking at is simply that. I think in the U.S. there's not being done enough in terms of government incentives.
No, we're not.
And
we're not.
Every time the economy goes down, like, we cannot grow the economy. Everybody's talking about a double recession and whatnot, and you're saying as well, we're nowhere near out of the worst. The worst is still to come.
Yep.
And we can only get out with growth and renewables.
Well, I think we can actually, Ben. I think that's a great start, and we need to make an investment in that here in the United States. Ben, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And over at TomHartman.com, you can get our free iPhone app, iPad app. You drop into our free live chat room, make your own blog. It's no cost for anything. Have fun.
When bad, it falls, you know it's got to be.
Anything Goes Friday. Yes, it's our Higgins alert. My crazy cat Higgins, who thinks he's a person. He doesn't get along well with other cats either. He actually thinks he's a curmudgeonly person. But he does know that he's a mammal. And so we just kind of use our Higgins alerts for cats and dogs. You know, he's Mitt Romney. What's the deal with Romney and dogs? Right? I don't get it. He ties his dog to the roof of his car for a drive all the way up into the, you know, nice, balmy, freezing cold Canada. The dog freaks out and has diarrhea down the back of the car. Romney pulls over, hoses down the dog, hoses down the car, and then drives off for another 4 hours with a shivering, freezing dog on top. As far as we can tell, that was the last the dog was ever seen. And now, his main bundler, Mitt Romney's main bundler, Fred Malik, the guy who's running around raising money and is hosting a fundraiser for the Romney campaign on Monday in honor of Ann Romney's birthday. Fred Malik, turns out 50 years ago, was arrested. I'll just quote this article from Hunt Walker. was arrested over 50 years ago in conjunction with an incident where a dog was killed and barbecued in an Illinois park. Yeah. Amazing. Well, enough on that. Let's... very quickly. This is from the dissent, Paez's dissent in this Ninth Circuit Court case. I disagree with Judge Bay's view that we may not consider evidence supporting the constitutionality of a law unless some of that evidence was present in the record before Congress at the time of the statute's enactment. In other words, I think it just stands. Yet Judge Bay repeatedly characterizes the government's burden as requiring a, quote, showing of substantial evidence, which must include substantial evidence in the record before Congress at the time of the statute's enactment, end quote, to support. And so that this is what the right-wingers are calling for. And Judge Paez pushing back. And if you have the PDF of this file, it's on page 3,968 and 3,969 of the decision. So, Joe in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Joe, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about progressive radio in America or the lack thereof. I often drive from Chicago with a listen to WCPT pretty much all the way through most of Indiana. By the time I get to Indiana, I can hardly get anything at all in the way of progressive radio. A little bit of 1310 out of Detroit. Then from there on in, all the way into D.C., I can get nothing until I get pretty close to D.C. And then in D.C., I have a terrible time getting 1380, especially when I'm downtown near the... in the central part of the city, and even in Arlington, Virginia, where my daughter lives.
Every station has spotty coverage areas. All of 1480 is going to be improving their antenna shortly, but they're doing a pretty good job. What's your point, Joe?
Well, my point is, I would like for you at some point to discuss how it is that Rush Limbaugh, especially who you can hear anytime, anywhere, all the way across the country. How is it? Are you there?
Yeah, I am.
I'm sorry. How is it that they are able to? I know there's some kind of special marketing program or something.
No, it's not special marketing programs. It is the power of 50,000 watt sticks. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Bain Financial, which owns Clear Channel right now, among others. Bain owns among others, but also in addition to Clear Channel. There are these 50,000 watt Clear Channel stations all across the country that carry Limbaugh, and there's a certain generative effect. I mean, he started his program back in 87, the year after Ronald Reagan knocked down the Fairness Doctrine. And you get on really big sticks. It's really quite startling. The stations, the cities where we're on a good-sized signal, we do really well. And by we, I'm talking about progressive radio in general. This show as well. I mean, I beat Rush Limbaugh on the ratings. In a couple of cities over the last, over the last few years. And others have beat other conservative programs as well. But there's two issues. One is the momentum issue. The other is that, Limbaugh has for years been saying, liberals listen to NPR. And I think that to a certain extent, he's true. He's right. And if this Ninth Circuit Court ruling stands up, then what you're going to find is that as public radio becomes increasingly polluted with right-wing issue ads and whatnot, that it's going to frankly, in my opinion, tear apart the fabric of NPR, and there's going to be a much larger market for an alternative to right-wing talk radio. Paul in Riffle, Colorado. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom, and it's Rifle, Colorado.
Rifle, okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to switch gears for a minute, since it's anything goes, and talk about the health of our planet and country out of consideration for my grandkids and my future grandkids. Mm-hmm. And it's regarding our president signing off on a new nuclear power plant, which I think you'll agree is really not practical as far as the waste of a nuclear power plant having such a long decay.
Yeah, the president doesn't sign off on these things, Paul. The state regulatory agencies, the two that are going to be built are down in Georgia, as I recall. And,
yeah.
And this is the, you know, this isn't the president's call.
Oh.
I mean, the NRC, if you've got a nuclear power plant that meets the standards, then the NRC has to say yes. And the standards are set by Congress. So if you've got a problem with that, and I do, I would suggest, let's roll back Price Anderson or let's change the standards. But, you know, right now they're moving ahead. I don't think, frankly, well, we'll see. I was going to say, I don't think these two power plants are actually going to get built, although, you know, they've broken ground and things, which is, at least for one of them, which is usually a sign that something is going to happen. So we'll see. But that's where you want to begin, Paul, is with Congress. Errol in El Sobrante, California. Hey, Errol, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. I've been listening to you for a while now, and it's the first time I've called in. I have one question. I watch CNN a lot, and when you watch the speeches actually going on in there, I find it remarkable how illogical and contrary to intuitive thinking that a lot of Republicans sound. And I don't really understand why the Democrats always cave when a Republican threatens the filibuster. Why don't they make them do it? Because if they have to get up there and talk, it'll show how specious their arguments are and how ill-informed they actually are. And as a CNN viewer, I would enjoy watching a Republican make a fool out of himself as he tries to defend a filibuster.
Well, Harry Reid arguably could at least stop Senate business. He can't force somebody to stand there and talk. That Jimmy Stewart goes to Washington ideal.
Well, I know, it's just
you know.
A movie, right?
Well, it's, you know, when the filibuster's been used, when it was used against the civil rights laws, it was not. It was just theater. It was just, you know, Strom Thurmond was just out there, you know, pitching to his base, basically, making sure that he got elected in the next election by scared white people back in North Carolina or South Carolina, wherever he was from. And so the filibuster's never been the way that we idealize it. You know, when Bernie stood on the floor of the Senate for, what, 7, 8, 9 hours sometime back, to filibuster.
Oh, yeah, it was very impressive. I watched the whole thing.
It was political theater, and he would be the first to tell you that. And it's, I don't disagree that it would be good to have a filibuster, but that requires changing the Senate rules. The problem is that if Harry Reid said right now, if the Republicans said, okay, we're not going to vote for cloture, we're not going to vote to end the debate on this particular topic, and Harry Reid said, okay, well, we're going to keep the floor open until you do vote to end the debate, in other words, we're going to keep the debate going, then the Republicans would simply say, okay, cool, you keep the floor open. We're going to go down to the restaurant down the street and have dinner. Or we're going to go to California and have a party. And it would just bring the Senate to a grinding halt, and nobody has a requirement to stand on the floor and keep talking. So you have to change. And so what Harry Reid has done, and, you know, to his credit, but, you know, tragically, this is the way the rules are set, is he said, okay, well, then we'll set that aside and we'll move on to the next issue. And the Republicans have, as you correctly pointed out, you know, just super gamed the system. There have been more Republican filibusters since President Obama became president than ever before in the history of the United States. Something that was
prompted my question.
Yeah,
it's
rare. Has been just, you know, wildly abused and overused. And the, you know, one solution, and there have actually been some proposals to do this, is to, and in fact, Bernie suggested it, is to change the Senate rules. Now, the Senate rules can only be reset every 2 years at the beginning of the new congressional session. So the time to do that would be this January, when the new Congress is sworn in, the first week of January of the new year. And, you know, there might be some energy building to do that. On the other hand, the Democrats are looking at this going, okay, the Senate, you know, right now they've got a slim majority in the Senate, but they don't have the 60 votes necessary to break a filibuster. Neither do the Republicans. But if the Republicans were to take a majority and the Democrats found themselves in the minority and they had gone ahead and changed the Senate rules so that, you know, it really required a real filibuster, then suddenly the Democrats are at a terrible disadvantage. So, you know, it's a knife that cuts both ways. And that's why they're very, very conservative, shall we say, about wielding it. Thanks, Errol, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the world, and more of your calls right after this.
We got politicians running races on corporate cash.
10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Well, six major world powers, including the United States, have opened nuclear talks with Iran tonight, as it is, in Istanbul, for the first time in more than a year.
Now, this is the group that includes includes Russia, China. Do I have this right?
Yes, it's the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany, as the P5 plus one.
Okay, great.
That's the little acronym.
Okay.
And so they are meeting with Iran. So they started off with a working dinner tonight, big talks tomorrow. Could go into Sunday, could not. What is going to be the measure of the success? The measure of the success could be something as small as Iran agrees to allow the nuclear inspectors back in and allows them to inspect sites that it forbade them to inspect in February. That will be seen as enough good faith to continue talks late in May. And that's the goal, to continue the talks. Iran has a good motivation for being here. They are already being bitten by sanctions. There's an oil embargo, and their central bank is being bitten. And coming in July, they have a pincer movement coming with the European Union's huge oil embargo and really tough sanctions from the United States targeting their central bank. And they need that money, and they need that bank if they're going to buy stuff for their nuclear program.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I understand that the Iranian public 2 years ago was broadly against their developing a nuclear program or a nuclear weapon even. And now, in part because of the sanctions or the threat of sanctions and the perception that the United States is trying to tell them what to do, the Iranian public opinion is moving more in the direction of Ahmadinejad and farther away from us. Do I have that right?
Yes, and this is something that has often been misread. Yes, they are a very American, Western-loving people, the young population of Iran. But they're a very proud people, the Persians, with a nationalistic streak. And if they feel that somebody's coming in and telling them what to do, they will back their leaders even if they hate them. And there's a message in there for anybody who wants to bomb them.
Yeah, yeah. And so we'll see how this plays out. What else is going on?
Also, a story that's not getting very much coverage because President Obama's summits don't. President Obama's going to Latin America tonight, to Colombia, for the Summit of the Americas. And it's interesting that it's in Colombia because on the agenda, along with trade and energy, will be drug trafficking. And Colombia is regarded as a bit of a success story in that area because it's really done a pretty good job to stop the decades-long killing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very interesting because drugs are a bit of a problem. Most leaders in the region believe the United States-led war on drugs has failed. They say it hasn't controlled supply, it hasn't reduced the ranks of drug lords and smugglers, it hasn't cut demand, and it hasn't changed consumer habits at home. And demand has risen sharply in Brazil also. So the president of Colombia, who's hosting the meeting, has put on the table the general topic of an alternative policy of drugs. The president of Guatemala is leading a call for the decriminalization of narcotics.
Wow. This would, just like the ending of Prohibition, though. I mean, you know, that basically put the Al Capones of the world out of business. If they decriminalized drugs, it would put the drug lords out of business.
It would put them out of business. I mean, I don't think it'll happen at this meeting, but the very fact that it's being discussed is frankly huge.
Yeah, and so the president of Guatemala is not, it had been Chavez or what's the fellow's name? It was the president of Ecuador.
Who's not coming? He's boycotting.
Yeah, who are considered a little more, you know, to the left of center than just your average president. You know, it would be more easily dismissed as probably the wrong word, but you know, considered kind of what you expected. But
this, yeah, a bit fringy. But this yeah. guy is not at all. Not at all.
Very interesting.
Also, today, the president signed an executive order establishing a high-level task force charged with coordinating federal oversight on domestic natural gas development. In other words, it's charged with ensuring that rapidly growing efforts to tap vast natural gas supplies in the country's shale formations, which require fracking, are safe and responsible.
Yeah.
To
that's
find
great.
A balance.
Let me just close up this loop on the last comment. I have tremendous respect for the president of Ecuador, who is, and he's one of the few representatives of indigenous people, if I'm remembering right, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, please, in at the level of president in any South American country. And am I remembering the right person?
I believe you are.
Okay.
Not a region I'm terribly familiar with.
Okay. We'll leave it right there then.
Yeah. My final story, as it's Friday, is that the American Nazi Party registered its first lobbyist this week.
Really?
Yes.
Do they have a super PAC yet?
Not yet, but I'm sure they're working on it.
Amazing. What do Nazis lobby for?
Well, that's interesting. They've registered to represent the AMP. They plan to lobby on political rights and ballot access laws. Also, several general lobbying issue areas, including civil rights, health care, and immigration.
So the American Nazi Party wants to pass more restrictive voter ID legislation, and they want to stop Obamacare. And, I'm assuming that their positions are consistent with the Republican Party on these issues.
You're prejudging, Tom.
I could be, but I get emails from these people.
I think you're probably right. This John Bowles was once a presidential candidate in 2008 for the National Socialist Movement.
Amazing. Now, this the National Socialist Movement, that's the group that is down in Sanford, Florida, walking around with guns and talking about white power. Is that the same as the American Nazi Party, or are they separate?
I think they're separate, but I think they're linked.
Yeah, that makes sense. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great checking in with you. Happy Friday the 13th. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, brilliantly representing the great state of Rhode Island, on the line with us. Senator Whitehouse, welcome.
How are you, Tom? Thank you for having me on your show.
I am fine, and thank you for showing up. And more importantly, thank you for championing the Buffett rule. Give us an outline of what you're planning for next week.
Well, I think the lead-in has been wonderful. President Obama has been really forceful on this issue and has raised its profile. It's one of these issues where on the merits, it's basically an indefensible status quo, but it does have some very powerful interests who do very well, thank you, from paying lower tax rates than ordinary mortals. And so it's, you know, going to take public pressure to make some of our colleagues move, and I think the president's done a wonderful job of stirring up that public pressure, and I would advise anybody listening to your show, if they want to add to that public pressure, to go check in at buffettrulebill.com and register as a citizen voter to add some fairness back into our tax system.
That's great. Buffett Rule, and it's two F's and two T's, right?
Yeah.
Buffettrulebill.com. And when Ronald Reagan came into office, the top marginal tax rate was 74%. And the United States had never, you know, outside of fighting wars, had never run a huge deficit in peacetime. And when Reagan left office, he had almost tripled the national debt, run up more debt than every president from George Washington and Jimmy Carter combined. And his promise was that, and if we simply cut taxes for the very wealthy from 74 down to 28%, that somehow that would generate revenue. It didn't work. How is it that it has taken us 30 years to figure this out?
You got me, and I actually, when I talk about this, I actually often cite President Reagan and actually give him some credit for this, because he's the guy who stood up and spoke out against what he called institutionalized unfairness in the tax code.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and I quote, "We want to see that everyone pays their fair share."
Right. Well, he actually.
What does that sound like?
Yeah.
And he condemned people who are, quote, manipulating the system to their advantage because they're rich and powerful. So, you know, the modern Republican Party has taken a big step away from Ronald Reagan on this issue.
Now, I had a caller on this the other day, and I wasn't absolutely certain of the answer. I'm so glad you're with us. Ronald Reagan raised the capital gains tax to 28% so that for at least 1 year, I think it was 83, it matched the ordinary income rate. And that was when he was talking about, you know, we shouldn't have these loopholes and things. And, well, actually, he talked about that for quite some time after that. But now the capital gains rate, the rate that people like Mitt Romney and Paris Hilton make, people who make their living waiting for the check to come in the mail, is 15%. And so under the Buffett rule, would those people, would Mitt Romney have to pay, after his first $1 million, would he have to pay 30% income tax? Or is it only on people who earn more than $1 million in ordinary income?
No, it is all income except municipal bond.
Tax-free
income.
Bonds.
We didn't want to interfere with the municipal bond market,
right.
But it would pick up the dodge of the hedge fund folks who basically pretend that their income is capital gains and pay 15% taxes on, you know, multi-hundred-million-dollar incomes.
In some cases, billion-dollar.
Yeah, I mean, the 400 highest taxpayers in the country, on average, in the last report that the IRS did, received over $270 million each in income in that 1 year. And on average, all added together in aggregate, they paid 18.2% in total federal taxes. A third of them paid below 15%.
Like Mitt Romney does. And that's less than a teacher in Wisconsin pays.
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Rhode Island, so my examples are Rhode Island examples. The year before, the 400 highest earners paid a lower tax rate than a single hospital orderly pushing a cart through the linoleum floors of Rhode Island Hospital at night.
Wow.
And in the following year, they paid a lower rate than a single Rhode Island truck driver taking packages around through the snow.
Amazing. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, the website is BuffettRuleBill.com. Get over there and check it out. And I wish you the very best, Senator, in taking this bill to the Senate next week, and encourage everybody to both check that website out and to call their senators and ask them to join you in what you're doing.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for taking it out to the people, because it's the people that are going to make this happen against the special interests. Thanks.
I absolutely agree, and thank you so much. Good talking with you, sir. Let's pick up on Anything Goes Friday here. Maria in Las Vegas. Hey, Maria, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's Maria in Vegas, and I'm glad I have a chance to talk with you. I love your show, and I love the way you address any issue that you come across.
Thank you. I don't always do the very best, but I do my best. Anyhow, what's up?
Okay. Well, I wanted to say that we need to change the landscape of our political structure in Washington, D.C. Mm. Especially, we should just get rid of every GOP Republican candidate, especially Tea Party people,
mm-hmm.
because they are like a decay. They're a sign of decay of Republican Party. Even the true Republican don't really care about them. And then we should focus on changing the landscape of Democrats in Washington, D.C., because I believe there is a Senator Sanders kind of independent or even a socialist, because the way I understand, he claimed to be a socialist independent candidate.
He identifies himself as a democratic socialist, so that's like a Norwegian or German or French, you know, the way that those countries are run, as opposed to, you know, the USSR socialist kind of thing. But yes, I'm totally with you, Marie. And we do need more Bernie Sanderses. Thank you very much for calling, and thanks for listening to SiriusXM. James in St. Charles, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, James, what's up?
Well, you were ranting a little bit about the Ninth Circuit ruling yesterday.
Yeah. I object to the ruling, number one. I'm astounded by the fact that it's another, you know, all the Republicans voted for it, all the Democrats voted against it, just like Citizens
right.
United. Three different places in the ruling, they cite Citizens United, and they talk about how Citizens United changed the First Amendment landscape in America. And then the lead judge has the audacity to say that, you know, Congress didn't do their homework when they passed this law.
And that's what I think is going to actually be a windfall for the progressives.
I think it's a sufficiently wonky topic that it's not even going to hit the evening news tonight.
I understand that, but if we take it and look at it this way, take that same logic and apply it to the Patriot Act, for example.
Yeah. Oh,
could we not get that rescinded?
Well, here's the problem. That's acknowledging that the Supreme Court or even some of the inferior courts, the circuit courts, should have the power to strike down laws by declaring them unconstitutional, A. And B, once you've given them that power, should be able to say that the basis of their judgment of the unconstitutionality of that law or the failure of that law to meet a constitutional test is that Congress didn't adequately hold hearings on it and document it in the congressional record.
Right.
What
I'm saying is if it stands and it gets upheld, then
we can go after bad laws. But I, you know, if this gets upheld and if that logic makes its way into the United States Supreme Court, I think that, you know, we have lost a large chunk of our democracy. I get your point, James, but I'm concerned.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And let's hope that some people talk about this, about the fact that these judges are saying, you know, we're going to control, we're going to decide what's good legislation and what is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Rebecca in Lyle, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, Tom. I was thinking about Earth Day. Of course, that's coming up pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be hearing a lot about good things that we should do, recycling and whatnot. But to me, it's all pretty much whistling in the wind. The real issue is human overpopulation. And you don't really hear people want to talk about it too much. Or if they do, they want to talk about it in some remote place that we don't want to think about.
Yeah. I disagree with you. I wrote a chapter about this in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org and is a major force in the environmental movement, wrote an entire book about it called Just One. And, you know, the consensus among scientists these days, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was, okay, we've got a population problem. People are having too many kids because they don't have access to birth control. And then there was, for a while, it was, oh, well, it's because when countries get wealthy, then population stabilizes, so we just have to raise the entire planet to our standard of living, which, of course, would require four planet Earths worth of raw materials to do. Ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now we find out that what it is the empowerment of women. That when women have political power and equal education in a community with men, or close to equal even, then population stabilizes very, very quickly. And so the population issue and the issue of equal access and equal power for women are very, very tightly interwoven, and we need to recognize that. We need to promote that and publicize that. Make sense?
Well, that sounds good to me, but, you know, it just seems to me that people are so clueless about this. overpopulation issue. You hear the right wingers say that we need to have more babies because of demographics, and we have an aging population.
Rebecca, that is just a total racist riff. Rebecca, thank you for the call. We've got a bunch of calls. I want to try and get folks in here. Joe in Staunton, Virginia.
It's Charles. Charles in Staunton, Virginia. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. I've called you before. Hey, I was listening to NPR today, Geeky Science, and they came up with a real great point today.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about the PETA principle and how people are promoted to their highest level of incompetency.
Right.
Okay, so then in doing this, they were looking at the government. So the Italian scientists did a study on this. And they found that in governments and corporations, that is what eventually causes them to fail. So they did an in-depth study in politicians, and they found the same thing in governments, that they keep promoting people to their highest level of incompetency from city council, right, because they people knew him, then they voted him for their local state representative. And then to
pretty soon you have the mayor of Wasilla being vice president of the United States, and you got a problem.
Exactly.
Your solution is to go back to the Greek lottery?
Right, the Greek lottery was that they would so many of the representatives were chosen at random.
Right, 6,000.
If you didn't put your name in the hat, it didn't go in, but so many were put into the hat and drawn, and they found that that's what stabilized the government and made them work successfully. I just wanted to know your take on that.
I think that there's a word for it that I'm missing right now. It's one of those arcane words for that type of government, and I'm not sure it's such a bad idea. It's how we do juries in the United States. And, when you register to vote, you're in the jury pool. And, if your name gets pulled out of the jury pool, then boom, you're on. And in the Greek democracy, if your name was pulled and you didn't show up, then they called you an idiota. That's where the word came from.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so where our word idiot came from. So, Joe, I'm fascinated by it. I'm not sure it's practical. It's not certainly, you'd have to blow up the Constitution pretty badly to make it happen. But it's a fascinating concept. Thanks for calling and riffing on it there. Lance in Palo Alto. Hey, Lance, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Good.
I was just calling. I'm glad to hear. I was just calling in because I wanted to talk about, make two comments, I guess. One of them would be this. I find it ironic in the Bay Area that the public schools are building schools for the charter schools. The reason I'm saying this is that we had a situation where a school was built with public funds, and then less than 6 months after that brand new school built completely with public funds was built, the school now says, oh, we want to become charter, and the school district, instead of allowing a public school which is there, to actually fill that school, they're allowing them to stay there, and then they're saying, well, they're going to pay increased leasing or increased rent on the property. And I'm like, that's kind of silly to me. Why is it that they would allow a brand new public school when you have a public school that's next to it that's dilapidated, that gets up to 100 degrees during the summer and as low as 50 or 40 in the winter? Why would they allow those public school kids that are staying there with public money to stay there and allow kids?
It's time, Lance, for us to acknowledge that the charter school experiment has failed. First of all, they should have been called private schools or corporate schools or, something like that. We used to call them private schools, back in the day, right? And then there were public schools. So, number one. And number two, when you look at when you compare apples to apples, when you look at kids in the same socioeconomic backgrounds, in public schools versus charter schools, you find no difference in outcome. And in fact, in many cases, public schools outperform charter schools. And the horrible thing that the charter schools are doing in the United States, in addition to siphoning resources off and doing things like what you're talking about, very often you find charter schools moving into buildings that used to be public schools. They cherry pick their students. So they have the ability of being private entities to say, no, we're not going to take the kids who are educationally challenged or who have a slightly lower IQ or come from from a more challenged family and are less likely to get, you know, tutoring on the side or even just support from mom and dad. We're not going to take those kids. We're going to leave them in the public schools. And then the public schools become educational ghettos, essentially. And as the public schools start, you know, sinking under the weight of this, and combined with all these Republican budget cuts, then the people who run the charter schools, the private schools, they point at that and go, hey, look at that. The public schools are failing you. You need to give us more money. It is time for it. Thank you, Lance, for the call. It's time for us to admit the charter school experiment, the private school experiment in this country using public funds for private schools has failed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But it's probably going to be a few more years before that one plays out. Back with more of your calls and Anything Goes Friday. Right? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Do you have your cheesy news bumper here? Or alert? Yeah, fire it off. All righty, here we go. From Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report. Serial killer Charles Manson was denied parole yesterday, effectively ending his bid for the 2012 Republican presidential nomination. With Mr. Manson no longer a contender, the path appears to be clear for former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney to become the party's nominee. Perhaps in recognition of this development, Mr. Romney unveiled a new campaign slogan today. Sorry, but you have no other choices now. As for the rest of the GOP field, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum suspended his campaign this week, saying that he wanted to, quote, spend more time with the voices in my head, end quote. And former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich wrote a $500 check on an account that had no money in it, in the first sign that he might be qualified to be president. Elsewhere, a Fox News spokesman blasted a mole who had previously worked for the network. At Fox News, we have zero tolerance for someone who tells the truth. Thank you, Andy Borowitz. Oh, my. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. And Mike in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really enjoy your show. This is the first time I've called in, though.
Thank you. What's on? What's in your mind?
Well, I was wondering, Pennsylvania recently adopted one of these voter ID laws. And, of course, it's one thing in Texas or South Carolina, which is a state that's going to go Republican no matter what. But, you know, Pennsylvania is a swing state. And
right.
It can be very important.
This is why they're aggressively targeting the swing states for these kinds of voter suppression laws.
So I spoke to our state senator in Harrisburg. She happens to be somebody I know because I'm in a bowling league with her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Senator Lisa Boscola, a Democrat. And she said, you know, they couldn't stop it. But what she did is she tried to attach an amendment which said this won't go into effect until the 2013 election, so that this year during the primary and general elections they could at least post signs so people know at least that next year they'll have to have ID. And that amendment was voted down, which indicated to her that this was all about suppressing the vote in November.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anybody who is elderly who has a difficult time getting out of their house, sorry, you can't vote. That's people who are concerned about Social Security and Medicare. Anybody who is, a student, anybody who lives in is going to have a hard time because they narrowly define, you know, what kind of ID and where it is and what, you know, if you're, how do you define your residency? If you're in school someplace for 9 or 10 months out of the year, is that where are you a resident? Anybody who lives in the city and doesn't own a car, like me, I don't own a car. I live here in Washington, D.C. Louise and I take public transportation everywhere. And, I have a driver's license because for years and years I drove. But if I had been born in this city and I'd never had a car because the metro is just spectacular here, I might not have a driver's license right now. So all those people get disenfranchised. You're absolutely right, Mike. This is what it's all about. The estimate is that so far 5 million people, many of whom don't even realize it, have been thrown off the voting rolls, you know, and they don't know it because they're not listening to political talk radio. They're watching sports or they're listening to music or, you know, watching sitcoms and things. And they're going to have a horrible surprise when the election time comes. Thanks for bringing it up, though, Mike. I appreciate it. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Steve. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. The only way that President Obama is going to clinch the election and get the kind of Congress that he can work with is to reach out to alternative party voters with a pledge for instant runoff voting so that we no longer have to choose between the lesser of two evils but can vote for anyone that we please without worrying about wasting our vote.
That would bring in the Green Party vote. And another variation on that is fusion voting, which they have in New York State, which is where you can be on the ballot of multiple parties. So you can be on the, well, for example, John Kennedy, when he famously gave his speech where he said, I'm proud to be a liberal, he was speaking before the Liberal Party in New York State, who had him on the ballot, and you could vote for him on the Liberal Party ballot, and it would show up as a Democratic vote, party vote as well. And but instant runoff voting is an even better way to do it. I'm totally with you, and the Green Party has gotten this in over 300 communities across the United States, the largest being San Francisco. The Democratic Party needs to embrace instant runoff voting. I'm totally with you. I would love to see it happen. Matt in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First, thanks for a book that you've written that's helped me with adult ADHD.
Oh,
I've got a comment and a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
First, I think that one of the problems with people, you know, of lower incomes feeling that they are, you know, getting hosed on taxes is that there are so many loopholes and that there are so many caveats for people who have money to pay someone to find them.
Well, and it's not even people of lower income. The median income in the United States is $26,000 a year. The average household income in the United States is around $44,000 a year. And so at those levels, people are paying very little tax, and they know that people making massively more than they are probably paying even less.
That's true also. And my question for you is, yesterday there was a discussion on your program about double taxation, and you were talking about the corporation that pays the clerk who goes to another corporation to buy something and all that.
Right.
What about the estate tax or inheritance tax? That's one that has always driven me insane. You know, there are parents are allowed to give gifts to children of $20,000 a year.
Is it 20? I thought it was 10.
Other provisions, but but you know, if my great grandmother, you know, worked every day and you know passed on the $5,000 she had left in her bank account or left to her name, you know,
it would not be taxed.
How fair is it for that?
The estate tax doesn't even kick in until you're talking about transferring millions of dollars. Number one. Multiple millions of dollars, and it's bounced all around over the last few years. And I think, frankly, it should probably be set at around $5 million. And I think that the estate tax should be a progressive tax; it should go up with the amount. But right now, it's at zero, and where it's going to go back to, I think, is at $3 million as a threshold if this temporary zero expires at the end of this year. But the point of you know, you're asking why we do it, right? And or why, you know, why would it be that if my dad dies, he can't just give me all that money? Well, first of all, he can give me the first couple million as a tax-free event if he had it. My dad didn't. but the second thing is that we tax transactions. And, you know, when you work for somebody, there's a transaction involved where they're giving you money. And at the point at which that money leaves their hand and goes into your hand, it gets taxed. If you go into a 7-Eleven and you buy gasoline, you go into a gas station, you buy gasoline. At the moment you buy the gasoline, you pay the gas tax. At the moment you buy the candy bar in the store, you pay the sales tax. So at the moment somebody's dead and their estate transfers to another person, that's a transaction. And that's the point at which it's taxed. That's the rationale. That's not the rationale for having it, but that's the rationale for it happening in that instant.
Sure, that makes sense. It just doesn't seem that, you know, if I were, let's say I were living at home with my father and, you know, the money that he is, taxed on from his income isn't taxed when he buys me a candy bar. You know, there's a transaction. So if I'm still, you know, maybe there's a difference between being a dependent and just being a child, but,
A big difference.
But, you know,
sorry, three or four thousand bucks a year.
The money has already been taxed within the family. Why tax it again?
The fact of the matter is, Matt, my guess is that neither one of us have enough money to be worrying about inheritance taxes for our kids, or neither one of us had parents who had so much money that we were even eligible for an inheritance tax and or an estate tax. And that's the thing that is crazy making about this, is that there are only about a couple hundred thousand people in the United States who will ever confront this, right, in any given year who are going to confront this. And most of them have estate planning systems that make sure that their kids are going to do just fine for the rest of their lives. Thank you very much. But this has been pushed, this whole thing of hiring Frank Luntz to come up with the name death tax and reframe it. It was secretly funded to the tune of lots and lots of money. And my recollection is it was over $100 million. I may be wrong. But in any case, it was funded secretly. It got outed after a couple of years by several of the Walton heirs. And these are people who are worth billions. The five Walton heirs in aggregate are the richest person in the United States and maybe in the world. I'm not sure. But, much richer than Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or anybody else. And they will lose a little bit in the estate tax, but their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, their five generations down are never, ever going to have to work. And you look at that and you think, why fight this? When there's a social good associated with it. And beyond that, the other reason for the estate tax is because this was not a nation that was founded on the idea of a landed gentry. One of the things that the founders objected to about England was that multi-generational wealth equaled multi-generational political power. And they do go hand in hand. Wealth and political power go hand in hand. And so they wanted to break that. None of the founders left estates that endure to this day. None of them. Great wealth in this country did not really arise until the Industrial Revolution, until after Reconstruction, with the era of the railroad barons, the banking barons, and the oil and steel barons, Carnegie, Rockefeller, Morgan, you know the names, Gould, those families. And prior to that, people didn't have huge estates and they didn't pass them along. That wasn't, in fact, that was viewed as fundamentally anti-American. The richest of all the founders was John Hancock, and in today's dollars, his entire estate was $700,000. Not his estate. I have no idea what it was when he died. It was far less than that because he lost a lot in the Revolutionary War. But he was worth $700,000. I mean, that's upper middle class in America right now, or the lower wealthy or whatever. So it's just that's the consideration, Mike.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So there's a whole bunch of really good reasons. Teddy Roosevelt actually used to make a really good argument for the estate tax. Chuck Collins and Bill Gates Sr. wrote a book about it. I recommend to you.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Paul Edney, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all of the people at our various syndicators, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others, to Don Rojas, Dennis Trunov, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly, to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Okay, JP in Detroit. Hey, JP, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Hey, Tom, an interesting anecdote before I ask a question. I got a call from somebody who claimed to be from the Republican Party while I was waiting and holding, and I have never had any association with the Republican Party whatsoever,
right,
other than to vote for a few candidates. So I thought that was an interesting coincidence. But getting to my question, you were as early as a couple weeks ago touting the effectiveness of Barack Obama's engagement with North Korea.
Right.
And in light of this provocative or dangerously provocative launch, are you still in favor of engaging these despots who murder millions of their own people in this manner?
You're talking about the talks with China and Russia and France and the U.K.
Yeah.
And I forget which
exactly. This process and, where you give them money and they
well, no, they're not giving them money. They're engaging in talks, and I am supportive of talks. Yes, absolutely.
Well,
I think that the last thing that you should do is start bombing people. We We ruined the lives of over 5 million Iraqis. Over 5 million people are permanent refugees. You know, they've lost their homes. They've lost their families. You've got hundreds of thousands of dead civilians in Iraq. Was that worth taking out Saddam Hussein?
If you look at it from the standpoint of a net...
Was that worth taking out Saddam Hussein?
We saved thousands of lives.
Oh, come on. That is crap. I'm sorry, JT. I am so close to the edge of my nonsense threshold here. Jim in Anacortes, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's up?
What's up? I'm wondering why nobody has wondered how many people have worked for Mrs. Romney, nurses, chauffeurs, cooks, so forth and so on. Bringing up 5 kids with domestics is very different than bringing up 5 kids without that kind of help.
Well, but let me add something to that. And this is part of the Hillary Rosen debate that I haven't heard anybody raise. And I'm surprised, frankly, that the media hasn't raised this question. If the Republicans are taking the position, as Ann Romney is doing now and the Romney campaign is pushing so hard, that raising a family as a non-working, in other words, not in the marketplace, mother, if that is work, and I don't disagree that it is, I've been saying for years that it is, if that is work, then why have the Republicans fought every attempt to make to quantify that work of raising those children so that stay-at-home moms are eligible for Social Security benefits and other benefits that you get from, or for that matter, tax deductions that you get from being in the workplace? Why is it that the Republicans refuse at law to call women who stay at home working moms, and yet at the same time, you know, they want to run around and wave the banner of Ann Romney? I don't get it.
That's a good point. Good point. What if the Koch brothers made buggy whips?
I beg your pardon?
In 1900. What if the Koch brothers made buggy whips in 1900?
Oh, we'd still be riding horses? Is that your point?
That's my point.
Okay. Yeah, good one. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call, Jim. Bill in Chicago. Hey, Bill. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Tom. I listen to your show every day, and I love what you do. Thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks.
The other day you said if it gets any worse, you were considering moving to Canada.
No, I joked.
I know you were joking, but in all seriousness, you alluded to the appellate court decision today. It just seems like if you're a progressive, if you're an enlightened forward thinker, it just seems like the situation is getting worse. I'm a unionist myself. Unions are under constant attack. Basically, if one were to choose to move to Canada, how does one do that?
Well, you can't unless you're quite wealthy. The Canadians have figured out what's going on here, you basically, you know, you have to demonstrate to the Canadian government that you're going to bring jobs and you're not going to be a drag on their government. And in fact, a friend of mine who is a physician, an American physician, got a job in Canada teaching in one of their universities and whatnot. And he hit 50 or 55, I forget which it was. And they just basically came to him and said, you got to leave the country now. You're reaching that age where you're going to start costing our healthcare system a lot of money. And therefore, it's time to boogie on out. So, you know, it's just not an option. But beyond that, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. I realize that's a horrible cliche. It's not a horrible cliche, but it's a cliche. But it's also true. The AA, you know, AA folks, and I don't have any personal or direct knowledge of this, so I might be mangling this, but my understanding of AA is that, you know, there's this story or metaphor that you have to hit bottom before you start seriously thinking about coming back up again. And I think that, frankly, as a nation, we're close to that, and we're seeing the insanity of these 30 years of Reaganomics and these insane free trade policies, and on it goes, right on down the road. And as Paul Ryan is doubling down on Reaganomics and trickle-down economics, and all the Republicans are going lockstep with him, I have a feeling they're going to go right over the edge like lemmings. So I'm actually... I believe the American people are not that stupid, Bill, and I'm very hopeful about this coming election. So I'm not planning on going anywhere. I intend to be right here. So anyhow, coming up Monday on the program, the right claims universities and college campuses are being taken over by radical left-wing professors. That should be an interesting one. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. not enough to just vote. I mean, show up all over the place throughout the year. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.